are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 27th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the clown show implodes. Scaramucci wants Priebus investigated for leaking public information. Jeff Sessions on the lam to El Salvador as conservatives tell Trump, no way. Jose, I guess I gotta say that. Republicans now fear their skinny repeal could actually be adopted. And Trump all alone in his bigoted attack on transgender people. Lastly, what was the matter with Kansas? Sam Brownback hits the eject button to be U.S. ambassador to religious fundamentalism. And is Steve Bannon's one good idea bullcrap? Trump White House attempting to blow up the Iran deal, and you have no idea how bad it is at ICE. But before we get to all of that, folks, on the phone, my hope is that we have Stephanie Taylor. She is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign. And this weekend, and starting today, in fact, I think Bernie Sanders is addressing you guys in about 25 minutes. 300 candidates from around the country are gathered to get training. Is that right, Stephanie?
That's right. We have 300 candidates, many of them in competitive races against Republicans, and they are all getting the nuts and bolts skills training that they need to go out and run best practices campaigns and win.
And so, all right, so what are we talking about? Are we talking about like city council? Are we talking about state elections, state Senate seats, state houses? What is it?
Almost everything. I mean, we've got folks who are running for alderman and city council and school board in their homes, and then we've got in their home districts, and then we've also got people running for state legislature, and we've got about 40 candidates who are running for congressional seats to unseat Republican incumbents, including in some of the races that are going to be the most hotly contested this cycle.
So, I mean, this type of how many years have you guys been doing something like this? And give me a sense of what the candidate pool looks like this year as opposed to other years.
So our training program, we've been operating for about 4 years now, and this is definitely the largest convergence that we've had with these 300 candidates. And I would say that this year we're seeing a lot more excitement, a lot more activists, a lot more people stepping up and wanting to run. I think that what we all saw, you know, was a huge wake-up call after Trump, and a lot of people said, you know, that it's time to go out and help build a movement of activists that are going out and trying to take power and take power back.
And, I mean, give me a sense of, I know there are other groups who are sponsoring this, but, I mean, where are these candidates, I mean, where are they coming from? Are they you know, and particularly the ones who are running in the more local races, and frankly, I'm 2018, obviously the congressional races are hugely important, perhaps as big of off-year elections as in my lifetime. And I would say that unequivocally. But I think, too, what a really key is building a strong bench in the state legislatures. Tuesday night, we saw the election of a Democrat in a special election in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire is one of those states that are on the brink of maybe flipping at least the state houses. And this is hugely important as we get into like the census and in 2020 and redistricting and whatnot. So, I mean, where, just give me a sense of like, where are these people coming from, and are there targeted races that you guys are focusing on, or is it just providing best practices for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real mix. You know, we've got folks coming who are taking on Paul Ryan and Jim Jordan, you know, some of the races that, you know, Dana Rohrabacher, Peter King, John Faso, these are some of the Republicans that are top targets for Democrats on the road to taking back the House in 2018. But then we've got other folks who are taking on some more long shot races. In North Carolina, Jenny Marshall is here. She's running against Virginia Fox. That's going to be a tough race, but you know what? We need to be competing everywhere, and we need to be telling a story everywhere about, you know, what the Republican agenda is like, and you know, force them to compete for every seat.
I've had many conversations, I mean, with yourself and also Adam Green, the co-founder of the PCCC, your co-founder, I should say, and you know, one of the things that I've that has always intrigued me about your organization is the way that you guys have, at various times, embedded, if not like personnel, but ideas into early campaigns, so that candidates can learn that they can win on a very progressive agenda. I mean, you guys were early involved in Elizabeth Warren's campaigns. And so how much do you guys filter out? I mean, when these people come in, give me the sense of how that works for you guys, because you guys obviously have an agenda that involves, you know, expansion of Social Security. I don't know where you guys are on healthcare in terms of single payer and whatnot, but give me a sense of that. And then, you know, do you guys use a filter, or do you bring people in and then try and show them polling that they can pursue these things? How does that work?
Yeah, we actually have a very competitive application process to come to this training. You know, we had about twice as many applications as we ended up having admitted candidates. We do apply that ideological filter that you were talking about. We're looking for those candidates who, you know, in their gut intuitively are on the side of people and not corporations, who understand that embracing popular issues like expanding Social Security or debt-free college, that these are winning issues. These are winning issues with independents and Republicans as well as Democrats, and that it's the best way to win, even in those tough, and especially in those tough red and purple districts, is to run as an economic populist. So we interview the candidates, they fill out a questionnaire. So we really make sure that we've got candidates in the room who agree and are ready to run on their values. And then we don't just train them in the nuts and bolts. We don't just train them in how to calculate their win number or how to mine their networks and talk to donors. We do all that too. But then we also talk to them about polling and messaging and do a lot of work to make sure that they feel confident that they can win if they run on their values.
And then is there a next level of support that you give a smaller number? I mean, you got 300 people there now. As you get closer to the midterm elections, do you then sort of say, like, okay, we met those people then, we have a better sense of how they're running over the past 6 months or whatever it is, 8 months, and these are the ones that are taking the positions that we think are the most progressive they can be taking in those districts. Is that how it works? Do you guys then offer more support? Tell me what the process is after this weekend.
Sure. So we have ways of offering ongoing support to all these candidates. We have, you know, ongoing online trainings that we'll offer. We have campaign software that they can use to run their best practices campaign, to manage their websites and their email lists and their endorsements and their press lists, that we make available to them. You know, our staff are always available to be sounding boards and answer questions. But then we also have an advanced candidate training for federal and statewide candidates that want to take their training to the next level. And then, of course, there's the Progressive Change Campaign Committee endorsement process, where some of these candidates will, you know, become formally endorsed by us. And when that happens, we'll raise money for them. We'll funnel in our million members as volunteers. We'll make sure that we're out knocking doors for them and that we're also providing them you know, top line expert strategic advice on things like messaging and media. And so there's a wide range of ways that we'll continue to support all of these candidates, but all of them should receive, you know, at least some support, even those who are running in really tiny local races.
So who are your, do you have competitors in this space? In other words, is Steny Hoyer sitting there and saying like, oh, these congresspeople went there, I'm a little bit, or these congressional candidates went there, I'm a little pissed off that that one did or that one did? And who are there competitors? I mean, does that make sense? Am I looking at that in the right way? It's just, you know, first person into their ear is helpful in terms of what, where they're headed on a trajectory.
Well, the good news is that progressives in the Democratic Party are way ahead of conservatives in the Democratic Party when it comes to building this kind of infrastructure and providing this kind of support to candidates. The bad news is that most of the millionaire self-funders that decide to run on the Democratic ticket are not our kind of candidates. And so, you know, they've got the money, but we've got the know-how. And so, you know, rather than being, you know, a competitor in terms of a training or technology program, I think it's just a matter of making sure we're running the smart, good campaigns that can beat a money advantage.
If people wanted to get more information about this, if there are potential candidates out there who are thinking like, I want to run for, state Senate or, the city council somewhere, can people still get in touch with the PCCC, get, some of these, learn some of these best practices, and where can people just more generally get more information on this?
Absolutely. Come to our website, boldprogressives.org. That's boldprogressives.org. And it will say, are you running for office? Click on that. And you will find all kinds of ways to sign up, get in our program, get information about upcoming trainings. You know, this is not the last training that we'll do this year or this cycle. And there'll be lots of opportunities in the future to get connected with us and get access to these resources. So come to boldprogressives.org and sign up.
All right, Stephanie Taylor, thanks so much for taking the time. I know you got to get over to Bernie Sanders' addressing you guys, and I know Elizabeth Warren may be speaking a little bit later today or tomorrow, I think it is, and others. So thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, folks. Boldprogressives.org, PCCC. I like that organization. I like that model of, it's basically getting them while they're young type of model. And
it seems like something a party should be doing anyway, perhaps.
Well, yes. I think the party probably does do that.
It's just not the
right
way.
It's just not necessarily, well, it's not even necessarily the right way. It's, I don't know if it's the right people. And, you know, look, it would be great if there was a sort of a third, you know, level of this that maybe is not as sort of even professional, but you're headed in the right direction. Let's put it that way. It is very difficult to run for office, particularly when you start talking about these congressional races. You need a lot of money. You know, John Faso, for instance, in New York 19, the Mercers dumped $7 million into his race. And so if you're going to go up against a guy like that, you're going to need some type of institutional support somewhere down the road. It's just a question of which institutions are going to do it. There's always problems and pluses and minuses with every institution. But if it's one, you know, it's coming out of, frankly, the DCCC, more often than not, I'm less happy about that. All right, let's get into what's going on today. It is another sort of insane day. As we speak, the Senate is starting to take a vote. They're going through a Votorama process where there's a lot of amendments that are put up. And it's simply, I guess it's sort of a procedural. It's part of the procedure for them to go through this as they contemplate the bill. Democrats, the last I heard, Democrats were not participating in this because they think the whole thing is a sham anyways. They know none of their amendments are going to pass. There's going to be an attempt by the Republicans to put a single payer up there as if it is they're going to go out and in 2018 claim that the Democrats have voted against the single payer provision. And Bernie Sanders, and what I love about this is, A, you know, Bernie Sanders is already out there talking for the Democrats on this, right? And he's saying, sorry, this is BS. I know it's BS. We all know it's BS. We're just not going to participate. And what's interesting is, and I think we mentioned this yesterday, the Republicans are basically working their way to this skinny repeal. What is the skinny repeal? It is a, and nobody's quite sure what's going to be in the skinny repeal, but everybody presumes that it's going to be a repeal of the individual mandate, a repeal of the employer mandate, and perhaps, a repeal of the medical device tax. And so the idea is that this is going to be just an empty shell of a bill that will go to the House and Senate conference. And I've seen some confusion about this on Twitter. I'm going to make this clear. They go and they try and reconcile their separate bills. But that is not what reconciliation is. Reconciliation is a different process that is sort of coincidentally happening in this instance. Reconciliation is basically where you take one bill a year, a budget resolution, and as long as it, according to, as long as it comports with the rules for reconciliation, the Byrd rules, which is that it has to deal with stuff that deals with the budget and has to be deficit neutral, then you can have a 50 plus one threshold as opposed to the potential for it to be filibustered. So the idea has been that the Republicans would just pass anything in the Senate to get it to this conference committee where they will meet with the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans will meet. They will hammer out a bill that will then go back to both houses. And if it's done through reconciliation, will have to comport with the Byrd rule. And then they'll vote on it again in those houses. Very difficult to imagine that a bill can come out of conference and comport with the Byrd rule in the Senate, because House Republicans are going to insist on defunding Planned Parenthood. Also, we found that the six-month waiting period, which is their version of the mandate, is not going to comport with the Byrd rule, so they're going to have to flip the filibuster. We talked all about this yesterday with David Dayen. Apparently, somebody else had the idea. It's not where this sort of bubbled up, but it's been funny to read about all the reactions from senators in the Republican caucus as they get faced with this potentiality, which is that they could pass a skinny repeal, which is, again, the repeal of the individual mandate, the repeal of the employer mandate, and the repeal of the medical device tax. And that, instead of going to conference, the House could decide, we're going to vote on that, and we're going to pass that. And the reason why they're afraid of that happening in the Senate is because the CBO scored a version of the skinny repeal. And it turns out what that does is that it, I get this here, it would provide health insurance for 16 million fewer people. Now, the Republicans will argue that, well, that 16 million, that's just because there's no mandates. And maybe there's a figure, let's just pulling these out of the air, but 8 million are individual and they decide not to buy health insurance. And the other 8 million are people who would have been covered by their employer who was subject to the mandate, and they're not going to buy health insurance. Now, the reason why they're not going to buy health insurance is, and this is very easy to understand, would you buy health insurance if it cost a dollar? Is there anyone in the sound of my voice, if it cost you a dollar a year to buy health insurance, would you say no? There's no one who is listening to me who would say, I would choose not to have health insurance.
I'd be upset if I was forced to by the government, though.
If you...
Oh, my God.
But would you buy health insurance if it cost you $30,000 a year? Well, what happens is that these people decide not to buy health insurance because it's too expensive. Or... And not just it's too expensive relative to what they perceive their risk because they're young, they're healthy. What happens is those people who think that their risk is higher of getting ill, or maybe they have kids or whatnot, they will buy that health insurance, and it would cause a spike, according to the CBO, in the current rates by over 20%. That's built in all the other spikes and rises we have, 20%. And it could very well, at that point, then create the death spiral where fewer people buy health insurance and only the sickest people end up buying it and the insurance companies back out. And it would really crash the exchanges. And as it is now, I think there's at least a decent awareness that the Trump administration is destroying and attacking exchanges. But the amount of blame that the Republicans would get would be astronomical if this goes through. So now they're terrified at the idea that the House may actually adopt the skinny repeal. So... It's a real mess. We won't know what happens until tonight, at least in terms of the Senate side. It's possible that the Senate will pass nothing, and then this will die again until the next time it's resurrected. But you can go to indivisibleguide.com/hubdialer-signup. It's a very catchy URL. indivisibleguide.com/hubdialer-signup. And you can call your senators there. And particularly if they pass this skinny deal, but get them to vote against it before then. This is just such a tremendous mess. They have no idea what they're voting on. They have no idea what the implications are of this thing. They're going to be voting on it in hours. They don't know if it's going to be adopted. Half of them are saying we're just doing this as to get a shell bill in there. The other half are saying, well, wait, what if this gets adopted by the House? Because they have no control over it. Once they pass it, they pass it. The House can do what it wants. And they may just say, like, we got to pass something. For all they know, this could be McConnell's plan. At least we're going to pass something. And they could also believe, like, look, and this is increasingly true. I mean, I'm looking at, there are 17 states in this country where Trump has an over 50% approval rating. And in those Republican districts in those states where he's somewhere between 40 and 50, I would imagine that those Republican districts tend to be evenly split. And I would also imagine that there's a strong correlation between the media outlets there in those districts. That all the radio is right-wing radio, that the local television has at least one Sinclair outlet, that Fox News has greater clearance there than any other cable news outlet. And then it's just a bet. Can we convince the American public that Obamacare has failed on its own and the Democrats wouldn't help us out? I don't know. I mean, Steve Bannon, there was a report by, this is sort of interesting, and I'm going to be talking to Naomi Klein over the next couple of days. We'll play that interview sometime next week. But this is pretty interesting. Ryan Grimm at The Intercept reported that three people who are close to Steve Bannon say that Steve Bannon is pushing for a 44% marginal tax rate on people making over $5 million a year. Now, in my estimation, this is a pretty good idea. We have no idea as to know whether or not Steve Bannon is just putting this out there so that there's a story floating around that Donald Trump is looking to tax the wealthy. And so that when the actual tax cuts for the wealthy get passed, there's still a lot of people who are still operating under the perspective of, yeah, they raise taxes on rich people to give tax cuts to middle class. There's apparently, according to the IRS, there would be 43,000 people who would be subject to that 44% rate above their first $5 million. So it would pull in around $18 billion a year, $180 billion a year. Now, there's a bit of a dilemma here, right? Because do you really want to tout Steve Bannon's policies? Not when you put it that way. Do you want to tout a 44% top marginal tax rate? Yes, unless you want a higher one. In 1963, the top marginal tax rate was 90% for every dollar you earned over $400,000. In today's dollars, that would be about $3.2 million. So for every dollar you earn over $3.2 million, from 1963, and really there was about a 10-15 year period where I think those were the tax rates, each dollar you made over $3.2 million, you pay 90 cents in taxes. So this is, relatively speaking, to the history of the United States, not such a radical idea. Part of the problem is that even those people ostensibly pushing back against Trump don't necessarily share those politics. Now, there was a tweet that took a lot of grief on Twitter. Deborah Messing, in capital letters, quote tweeted Ryan Grimm's news story about Bannon pushing for a 44% marginal tax rate on people making over $5 million a year. She wrote, "This is disgusting," in all caps. Now, I don't know if that's a joke, if it's ironic or not. I'm guessing it's not, because I suspect she took a lot of grief. I saw then Glenn Greenwald retweeted her tweet out, calling her a leader of the resistance. I take a little bit of an issue with her being a leader of the resistance. I don't know how many followers she has on YouTube, but on Twitter. But Matt, did you even know who Deborah Messing was?
No, I did not. I haven't taken any orders from Deborah Messing as part of my duties in the resistance.
I saw the tweet. I saw the tweet. I know who she is, and I have.
Do you perceive her as as your leader?
No, I don't have a leader, not even you.
Well, no, I wasn't. The thing is, my leader is Bronson Pinchot.
Oh,
the guy was on. Was it Bosom Buddy? Bosom Buddies. Oh, Perfect Strangers. Yes, sorry. He was on Perfect Strangers. He's my leader.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Oh,
You don't remember? He was the guy in. He was also in one of those Eddie Murphy movies. You get the coffee.
Oh, no, he was also in.
I can't remember.
Oh God, what movie was that where he just had a bag of cocaine? I have a question, really.
But wait, let me just finish
about Deborah Messing.
Hold on, let me just finish this. The point being that there's always this dilemma with the resistance that the politics are bad. And B, there's also this problem of people sort of looking for any opportunity to suggest that the leaders of the resistance. I think both. I have a problem with both. So I would just have quote tweeted the entire exchange and put, this is gross. But
all the responses are sort
of... 44% marginal tax rate on people making over $5 million. Good idea. Maybe higher would be even better, but that's it.
I have a question. From the tweet, it just seems like Deborah Messing is a conservative. But the thing that crossed my mind is, and you would know more about this, is would this have a high impact on people who might make nothing in 1 year, such as like actors who might make close to nothing in 1 year and then make a lot in another year and then it be very up and down, and so they would have an unreliable income? Is this like what would go through someone like her's mind?
No, what would go through her mind is that she doesn't want to she doesn't want to pay higher taxes.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. Like, if you make $5 million in 1 year,
right,
and then you don't make any more money for the next 4 or 5 or 6 years, that 44% as opposed to 33% is not going to make the big difference for you. What I would do is, if you're an actor, you want some advice, if you make $5 million in 1 year, save your money until you feel confident that you're going to make some money on the out years.
But they need like golden cars or whatever to be famous.
I would hold off on the golden cars.
Yeah, I mean, I'm generally very in favor of the higher rates too. But I do think that Kelly's point is an interesting one to think about in terms of policy, because you have like athletes, for instance, that might only play like 3 years, yeah, and they have like they'll get a huge chunk of their income taken. I mean, I think you structure it against wealth.
Structure it.
Right.
And structure,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you really want to, if you're really concerned that you're not going to have it in the out years, then structure it differently.
I'm not against it. Absolutely not. I was just wondering if, I just obviously a contrarian, why would somebody think like this if they are not?
J.K. Rowling has had a lot of similar responses.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, the bottom line is the reason why people would think about this is that Mort Saul used to say everybody's a liberal until it costs them a quarter.
That's not true.
Well, I understand it's maybe a little bit hyperbole. He's a comedian, and he was just making a satirical point. But that's the point. And Deborah Messing, maybe Deborah Messing is touring around with Mort Saul. Right. And
I mean,
J.K.
Rowling's
a
really good example, too. Matt's just way better than I am at a lot of things, but J.K. Rowling and athletes, that's a good example.
But I don't think it's a good example. I think J.K. Rowling's embarrassed herself by a lot of her political statements about things like labor policy, about tax and that sort of thing.
Okay, I don't follow her political
views. All right, let me get into the other sort of drama that's playing out, and we'll work our way through the dramas. Jeff Sessions, of course, has been taking it on the chin. Poor Jeff Sessions has been taking it on the chin. And from President Trump, because he recused himself from the Russia investigation.
Unfair to the president.
Unfair. Totally unfair. Well, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And where do they go? They go to El Salvador to talk about the MS-13 gang. Jeff Sessions has left the country. In the meantime, what is going on? And it's clear. The conservative media, particularly like Breitbart, the white nationalist media, is out in full force protecting Jeff Sessions. And the Senate, Republicans in the Senate, here is Lindsey Graham expressing the fact that they don't appreciate that Jeff Sessions is humiliated by the president.
This effort to basically marginalize and humiliate the attorney general is not going over well in the Senate. I don't think it's going on over well in the conservative world. If Jeff Sessions is fired, there will be holy hell to pay. Any effort to go after Mueller could be the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency, unless Mueller did something wrong. Right now, I have no reason to believe that Mueller is compromised.
Okay, so here's what's going on. There has been a lot of speculation that what Donald Trump has been doing when he goes out and he says this stuff about Sessions, he's trying to take the temperature of the Senate to see if there's going to be any implications of him firing Jeff Sessions. You've got Lindsey Graham saying that. Now, if I was in the White House, I'd say, well, when was the last time that Lindsey Graham actually said something that he meant anyways? I mean, this is he and McCain professionally strike a righteous pose, and then when it comes time to do anything about it, they don't do anything anyway. So who cares what he says? But Chuck Grassley tweeted out the following tweet. Everybody in D.C. should be warned, and I love the fact that he's... He's got to shorten his...
He's in the Grassley style guide.
Yeah. S-H-L-D, and then just the letter B. Warned that the agenda for the Judiciary Committee is set for the rest of 2017, period. I love the fact that he's using, like, you know, then he's using punctuation. Judges first, sub-cabinet second, / AG, no way. And despite the fact that he was using his own style guide there, what he's basically saying is you will not get a new AG if you fire Jeff Sessions, which means that Rod Rosenstein will be the acting AG, not just in regards to the Russian investigations, but in regards to everything. Donald Trump has supposedly spoken publicly, or I guess around the White House, I should say, about the idea of potentially doing a recess appointment. My understanding is the Democrats have already planned to make sure that there is no technical recess by essentially, there's procedural tricks, but it sort of amounts to like a filibuster of the motion to recess. And so the Senate will never be officially recessed. This was a trick that Mitch McConnell used to prevent President Obama from appointing members of the National Labor Relations Board back when there was not enough members to fill it. So this is playing out, and in the end, you know, Jeff Sessions will get the phone call from Lindsey Graham, and he'll tell him, it's time for you to come back. You can leave El Salvador now. And he'll return and get back to the hard work of suppressing black people's votes and ginning up the drug war and attacking immigrants in this country. So for me personally, I'd like to see Jeff Sessions go by hook or crook, because there really can't be a worse attorney general. But let's move on to the other drama that is going on, because it's been a long 24 hours. As you know, Anthony Scaramouche.
Scaramouche.
Is the new comms director. And boy, he's really getting at it. So last night, it was reported that Scaramouche earned $4.9 million from his ownership stake in an entity called SkyBridge, in addition to more than $5 million in salary between January 1st, 2016 and the end of June 2017 when he joined the Export-Import Bank. And apparently he was also still getting paid while he was on the Export-Import Bank. It is part of his disclosure form, which is publicly available upon request, but had yet to be reported. Remember what I just said. Now, the SkyBridge website continues to advertise Scaramucci as the firm's managing director. He attempted to sell this, or started the process of selling this, in January to Ron Transatlantic and a Chinese conglomerate, HNA Group. The sale has been held up by regulators who are looking at certain potential improprieties.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche.
But last night, apparently, Scaramouche at 10:40 got super pissed. And he tweeted out, in light of the leak of my financial disclosure info, which is a felony. Now, there's a lot of work being done in that first sentence. But I should tell you that, A, his financial disclosure was not leaked. It's publicly available on request. And B, as such, it is not a felony. It's not even a misdemeanor. It's not even bad form. He goes on to write, I will be contacting at FBI and the at Justice Department, hashtag swamp, and strangely, at Reince 45 Reince Priebus.
Oh my God.
And so then people were like, wait a second, is he implying that Reince Priebus was the leaker of his financial disclosure stuff, which can't be leaked anyways because it's publicly available? Well, apparently a reporter called him, and the reporter said, yeah, he confirmed it. Meanwhile, there was a piece by Axios saying Scaramucci appears to want Priebus investigated by the FBI, and Scaramucci at 11:47 p.m. last night wrote, wrong. Tweet was public notice to leakers that all senior administration officials are helping to end illegal leaks. Reince 45.
Scaramucci, Scaramucci.
And so this morning,
oh my God,
after another reporter had spoken to him and said, yeah, he thinks it's Reince who leaked, he went on, he called in as they were talking to the reporter on New Day.
Ryan Lizza.
Ryan Lizza. Ryan Lizza is talking to Chris Cuomo and what's her name again? I can't remember.
Allison
Camerata. And then all of a sudden, Scaramucci, who apparently was watching CNN, calls in. And this is, now where are we? Which one's this? Is this number seven?
Yeah,
this is the start of the segment. Here we go.
Anthony Scaramucci on the phone.
Right, so let's get him. White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci joins us this morning. Anthony Scaramucci, can you hear us?
Is Ryan still there? Yeah, so when I was speaking to you last night, Ryan, I said it was unpatriotic that you weren't telling me who the leakers were. I was on a plane landing in New York. I have to go visit my mom. And so you may have caught it the wrong way. I was teasing you, and it was sarcastic. It was one Italian to another. It wasn't me trying to get you to say, if you could give me some sense for where they are, because I have a responsibility to the President of the United States.
Anthony?
When you said you,
yeah,
when
pause
you said
it. Let me just, as Cuomo tries to get control of a rambling Anthony Scaramucci, he is responding to what Ryan Lizza had just said, that Scaramucci had told him when he spoke on the phone last night that he was being unpatriotic by not telling Scaramucci who his leakers are at the White House. And now Scaramucci, go back so we could hear this again, because Scaramucci is saying to Ryan Lizza, he's talking to Ryan Lizza, who he thinks is still on the phone, who very well may be, because I think Ryan Lizza is just sitting there like mouth agape. And Scaramucci saying one Italian to another, I was just asking you who the leaker was, and you didn't want to tell me. Come on, here we go.
Telling me who the leakers were. I was on a plane landing in New York. I have to go visit my mom. And so you may have caught it the wrong way. I was teasing you, and it was sarcastic. It was one Italian to another. It wasn't me trying to get you to say, if you could give me some sense for where they are, because I have a responsibility to the President of the United States.
Anthony?
When you said you didn't, I totally respect your journalism and your integrity.
Anthony, Chris, Anthony. I just want to make sure, I don't know if Ryan could hear you.
I can.
But just in case, it did go out over the air, so he heard what you meant when you were talking to him.
Pause it. Now, I think that Chris Cuomo thinks at this point that Scaramucci doesn't realize he's on air talking to Ryan Lizza. He thinks he's just connected to Ryan Lizza by some type of party connection, and Cuomo is making it clear to Scaramucci, like, you realize you're on air now, right? Like, because he doesn't realize what's about to happen for the next 30 minutes, that Scaramucci is going to have a half breakdown on the phone. Continue.
But just in case, it did go out over the air, so he heard what you meant when you were talking to him about being unpatriotic. Let's just reset us at zero here.
Yes.
What's going on in your perspective?
I want to reset at zero, but I also want you to know that I just spent about 15 minutes on the phone talking with the President of the United States, who has given me his full support and his full blessing. And I'm gonna read you something, Chris, and you bear with me. And the President also told me, if you're nice to me in this segment, he'll let me come back on the show. Is that cool? So why don't you let me talk for a little bit, and then you can ask me questions. But this is super, super important to the country. Now, whether you agree with the President or you disagree with the President, you have to love the institution of the presidency. You have to love the office, and you have to love our country. And what is going on right now, I've done a major amount of work over the last 5 days. I've interviewed most of the assistants to the President. I've interviewed most of the people in the communications team in the White House. And what the President and I would like to tell everybody, we have a very, very good idea of who the leakers are, who the senior leakers are in the White House.
Leakers.
We'll get to that in a second.
So, yes, so Scaramucci goes on. I mean, there's literally we could play the whole half hour. He was on for a half an hour on the phone. Scaramucci, this is the best part. Well, I don't know if this is the best part, but this is a good part of the Scaramucci conversation with Chris Cuomo. At one point, right? Now, we read off the tweet that he launched at about 10:40 at night. Put that tweet back up for a second so I can read it. So Scaramucci, Wednesday night, writes, in the light of the leak of my financial disclosure, which again was not a leak, it's publicly available information, which is a felony, which it's not, of course, because it's public information, it's not even a misdemeanor, I will be contacting the FBI and the Justice Department, hashtag swamp, and then he tags Reince Priebus. And people assumed this is him accusing Reince Priebus or putting him on notice, like, hey, I'm talking to the FBI and the Justice Department. And so here is Scaramucci saying, I have a very good idea who the senior leakers are. And a lot of reporters thought that I put the Reince on there to accuse him. Wrong. It was a trap.
Now, if you want to talk about the chief of staff, we have had odds. We have had differences. When I said we were brothers from the podium,
pause it.
Because
now Scaramucci is talking about his relationship with Reince Priebus, which apparently early on, because Reince Priebus, of course, was reported publicly that he did not want Scaramucci to have this position, and Reince Priebus now looking like I don't know, a genius is the right word, but. There's some vindication, of course, not with Donald Trump, but with just about everybody else. But here it is.
From the podium, that's because we're rough on each other. Some brothers are like Cain and Abel. Other brothers can fight with each other and get along. I don't know if this is repairable or not. That will be up to the President. But he's the chief of staff. He's responsible for understanding and uncovering and helping me do that inside the White House, which is why I put that tweet out last night. When the journalists who actually know who the leakers are, like Ryan Lizza. They know the leakers. Jonathan Swain at Axio. These guys know who the leakers are. I respect them for not telling me because I understand and respect journalistic integrity. However, when I put out a tweet and I put Reince's name in the tweet, they're all making the assumption that it's him because journalists know who the leakers are. So if Reince wants to explain that he's not a leaker, let him do that.
Aha! He tricked them all. Scaramouche. He tricked them all. He knew if he attached Reince on there, everybody would assume that Reince was the leaker because they already knew he was the leaker. Anthony, you did a great job. That was perfect. Super spy stuff.
They prejudged it because they're guilty.
They knew it. Now, of course, if he had not put Reince on there and left it off, that would also, or let's put it this way, if the reporters had not come to the conclusion that Reince was the leaker, that would prove that he was the leaker because they're obviously protecting him even though Scaramouche has just fingered him.
There's always the option of not tweeting this.
He should have took that option a number of times last night, I think.
And here at the end, well, not the end. I mean, there's literally we could play 30 minutes.
Just like
of this.
15 minutes later.
But as you know, winding its way through the Senate and the House, in fact, I think it's now basically there. Bob Corker has dropped his objections as of Wednesday about the House bill that suggested sanctions on North Korea, Russia, and Iran. The Senate will look to approve the House version, but Corker wanted the House leaders to consider and pass enhancements to the North Korea language. Basically, that would, it's unclear to me what Corker wanted, but I think it was issues about just how aggressive, I guess, we would be with North Korea. The Iran stuff, again, is, you know, sort of meaningless because they want sanctions to be imposed not just unilaterally, and the rest of the world is just not going to go with it. The big issue in this Russia sanctions is that the president would not be able to unilaterally repeal these sanctions. There's a chance that President Obama will veto it. It appears with the support that it has now that it's President Trump will veto it, sending it back to the House and Senate for a veto override. But here is Anthony Scaramouche suggesting why President Trump might veto it.
Right now, he may decide to veto the sanctions and
why?
Be tougher on the Russians than the Congress.
Oh, so you think that if he vetoes it, it's because he wants something tougher than what they have in the sanctions bill?
He may sign the sanctions exactly the way they are, or he may veto the sanctions and negotiate an even tougher deal against the Russians. He is a counterintuitive, counter-punching personality that, let me tell you, I was in Youngstown, Ohio with him. You cannot believe the fan base there. The American people get it. American people like what he's doing. The establishment does not like what he's doing. He's going to disrupt the establishment.
Why do you call the majority of America
to make it fair
the establishment?
For the American people?
Why do you-
All right. Putting aside Chris Cuomo's missing sort of a really important aspect of what Scaramucci has suggested, if Donald Trump wanted to make those Russian sanctions tougher on Russia, all he would have to do at this point is come out and say, I'd like to see tougher sanctions on Russia and begin negotiating before the bill is passed. There's no need to wait to veto it. So, I mean, it's obviously a lie. And it's one that I think Chris Cuomo should really sort of key into because when Trump does veto it, I think that you're going to find that's the lie that they're telling. The weird part will be then the Senate and the House will just say, like, okay. And then he'll have to sign that one. But I also think they're going to be able to override his veto. So that was Scaramouche.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche.
It's only been, what, now, was 36 hours since he took the job?
Yeah, he's taken it by storm.
Yeah, well, this is the way you got to go in there. I mean,
there's a clip. There's a clip of him talking to a BBC journalist about burgers and pizzas that we're not even going to get to today.
No, that's too bad.
No, why?
Should we not get to it today?
Please.
All right, we're going to take a break. Oh, we've gone long. Gone long again. Folks, we're going to head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I mean, today was sort of fun in the first half.
And terrifying. I mean, we also need to realize.
I mean, I
it's funny how crazy.
I mean, I would like to talk about the DOE and nukes all the time, but.
I have no problem with, I mean, this stuff doesn't, the total incompetence of Scaramouche and Reince fighting, I'm down with that. That's fine. I mean, there's a basic incompetence that's embedded in this administration, and it is going to be a problem when we hit a crisis, which inevitably happens, regardless of what's going on with Scaramouche and Reince Priebus. In the fun half, we will talk about what has been reported now on this supposed ban of transgender people from the military. Apparently, no one in the military was aware of this. No one in the administration was aware of this. That this came out of a, we'll talk about it in the fun half, but it basically came out of an ask from Congress that appears to have been misinterpreted by Donald Trump. And so he just said, oh, it was tweeted out. I mean, who knows? I don't know where we go from here. I mean, we have a Secretary of State. I just want to remind everybody who's taking a break. Is he on vacation for a couple of days? No, he's taking a break. So I got that tweet from Michael today. I'm taking a break. He's not showing up today.
That's not true.
So he said, taking a break.
Wayne Tracker mode.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, it is your support of this program that makes it possible. By becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you support this daily free show that you listen to two or three times a week. Maybe if you listen to it five times a week. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. And also, we say thank you. Thank you. Thank you to our members. If you can't afford it, but you want the extra content, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have patience because, you know, we get a lot of emails. But we will get to you and we will hook you up. We don't want to lock anybody out for financial reasons. But if you're one of those people who are fortunate enough to not have any financial stress at the moment, and you can't afford to support the program, please do. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And also, if you go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on either the Amazon or Jet.com link. You can purchase your Amazon or Jet.com stuff. Through those links, we get a kickback, which is why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Just a programming note, tomorrow we will be live at 11 a.m. Early show tomorrow. Early show tomorrow, Friday, 11 a.m. All right, see you in the fun half.
know me.